From KCRW, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food.
Your body is inflamed. If you haven't felt it yet, you or someone close to you soon will. Symptoms to look for include uncontrolled weight gain or unexpected weight loss, skin rashes, difficulty with memory, fever, trouble breathing, and chest pain. Inflammation accompanies almost every disease in the modern world. Heart disease, cancer, inflammatory bowel disease, Alzheimer's, depression, obesity, diabetes, and more. The difference between a mild course and a fatal case of COVID-19 is the presence or absence of systemic inflammation.
Did that get your attention? If you didn't think about inflammation before COVID, I'll bet you do now. But what if the idea of inflammation weren't reduced to a body part or system, devastating as that can be? What if we looked at our world and the societies within it as examples of not just real, but metaphorical inflammation as well? What if the inflammation of our arteries and that of the planet are linked? As Dr. Rupa Marya and journalist Raj Patel say, racial violence, economic precarity, industrial pollution, poor diet, and even the water you drink can inflame you. Their book is Inflamed. Hi, Rupa and Raj. Could each of you kind of introduce yourselves, tell us what you do and what led you to collaborate together on this new book? Rupa, you go first.
Sure. I am a doctor of hospital medicine at the University of California in San Francisco. I'm a co-founder of the Do No Harm Coalition. We're a group of health workers dismantling structures of oppression in order to get health for our communities. And I am a mother and a musician with the band Rupa and the April Fishes. And it was really through my work in music that brought me to communities and to places where you could really see the intersection between society and illness. And what I started noticing over my, 15, 20 years of touring to these different communities is that people who were suffering under the brunt of colonialism were experiencing inflammatory disease in much more profound, impacted ways. And so I started to think about this as I was going in between my work, down in Chiapas on tour with the band and then back in the hospital at UCSF. And I started to see these parallels and started reading people's bodies in the hospital through this language of history and power and looking at how the systems around us are making us sick. And, in my friendship with Raj and looking at his work in the food systems and his work with communities that he works with, there were a lot of parallels in thinking about why people are getting sick in the ways in which we are.
And Raj?
I'm a research professor in the Lyndon Baines Johnson School of Public Affairs here at the University of Texas in Austin. And I'm one of the members of the International Panel of Experts on Sustainable Food Systems. And I've sort of got here by doing a lot of work around studying peasant movements and studying food systems. And through this collaboration with Rupa, I came to understand that a lot of the times what I was seeing when I was lucky enough to be, an activist on the ground with peasant movements in lots of different parts of the world was not just stuff happening around food, but stuff happening around medicine. In a lot of communities around the world, food and medicine are things that are coextensive. There's no hard and fast line between one and the other. And it really, through this collaboration with Rupa, what I got to understand a lot better was why a lot of the food system is also a part of a medicine system outside the sort of confines of the United States.
Approximately what percentage of global human deaths are from environmental factors in air, water, or soil?
But in 2012, a quarter of all human deaths were traceable to environmental factors in the air, water, and soil.
So while environmental causes have been connected to 25% of global deaths, chronic inflammation is now thought to be the most significant cause of death in the world today, with more than 50% of all deaths globally attributed to inflammation-related diseases.
And this idea of inflammation, from a food perspective, we see it in the amount of carbohydrates we eat, the kind of sugar and fat-laden foods that are marketed to us that we're told cause great amounts of inflammation. Can you kind of take that thread and spool it out into this other connection that you're making that is a larger connection to class, history, and society at large?
So we had the great pleasure of talking to Valerie Segrest, who is part of the Muckleshoot Food Sovereignty Project. The Muckleshoot Nation was for a long time where Seattle is now. And you know, Val was talking to us about how, for example, a lot of the food ways that her people and her nation had for generations lived with were high in fat. And the way that Western nutrition and nutritionism transformed that is to selectively isolate little components in the food and decide that things were good or bad for you. And that was part of a longer sort of process in which, for example, the confectionery industry and the sugar manufacturers, you know, ganged up and tried to make sugar the good guy and fat the bad guy. And there are long histories about some of that. But the way in which we think about food as, oh, it's salt and fat and sugar and isn't this all bad, is itself a product of colonial capitalism. It atomizes our food into individual components rather than understands our food as part of rich food ways that are about relationships between humans, for example, and the salmon nation. And Val was telling us a great deal about how, you know, that there are treaties between certain human nations and the salmon nation, and those treaties involve duties of care and respect. And care and respect is absolutely not the way that we're taught to think about our food, in which, you know, if we think about our food at all, it's, you know, just sort of looking at the side and checking off whether the appropriate vitamins are there or whether it conforms to our high carb or low carb or high protein or low protein diet, as opposed to understanding it, understanding the food that goes through us as part of cycles of food and medicine of which we are inextricably a part.
And sort of to take that a step further, even the way we're seen as individual workers who are part of production, we're not seen as part of any whole, any part of any spiritual practice or spiritual whole. We're just a cog, which has become so visible during this period of COVID. And we're seeing this pushback of people not wanting to return to work. Rupa, could you speak to that a bit?
Well, this is exactly related to the food system. So what Raj was just speaking to was the integration of people into the web of life, into the whole system, within systems that support vitality and health. And what colonial capitalism has done is change those relationships categorically around the world of people to the web of life. And what we're seeing is the web of life has become increasingly frayed and is at the point of collapsing. Our planetary weather patterns, our ability to know when seeds are going to sprout, the timing with the insect population, even the presence of the insect population. You know, we used to drive around and have to clean our windshields because there were so many bugs on them. And that hasn't happened. I haven't had to clean my windshields because of dead bugs in a really long time. And that's a problem. These relationships between food, medicine, the web of life and people have been categorically changed over the last 600 years through relationships that were put in place by colonialism and really codified through our systems of capitalism, which are all about extraction and all about concentrating, you know, wealth and health in an increasingly small number of people.
Could you describe stress and inflammation and the idea of homeostasis, how they work with one another?
Yeah. So over the last 10, 15 years, the study of inflammation and inflammatory disease has really taken big leaps and strides, where now in medicine, we understand that almost all the diseases I treat as a hospital medicine doctor at UCSF, so from cardiovascular disease, heart attacks, strokes, diabetes, inflammatory bowel disease, now the leading cause of end-stage liver disease, asthma, COPD, all of these diseases, Alzheimer's disease, have inflammation as a major part of the onset and development of these diseases. And so what we know about inflammation is that it is the body's natural healthy response to the threat of damage or damage. And what usually happens in an acute inflammatory response, so in the light of getting a paper cut, you have an inflammatory response that goes to heal the wound. So this is a corrective response of the body. It's an ancient response of the body. And what happens with a wound is that, you know, when the wound is healed, the inflammatory response turns off. This is a healing response. But when the damage keeps coming to the body, whether it's through, you know, air pollution or dietary chemicals or pesticides in our soils that end up on our foods, or police violence, or living in extremely close quarters, or living without access to potable water, there's all sorts of different kinds of stressors. In the presence of that ongoing damage, the inflammation never stops. And our bodies are constantly trying to reset the optimum working condition, which is called homeostasis.
How are salmon to rivers as hearts are to blood vessels?
I love the salmon. So we got to interview Chief Colleen Sisk, who is the Winnemem-Wintu chief, who's been working at the base of Mount Shasta, where her people are from, on restoring the health of the salmon. And she's been opposing the raising of the Shasta Dam because it's been destroying the ecology of the rivers that have been vital to salmon health. What we see, if you know, the rivers are the Earth's vasculature, the salmon are bringing the nutrients in from the ocean, the phosphorus and the nitrogen from the ocean back into our forests. So you can find nitrogen that comes from the ocean up in the tallest parts of a Douglas fir tree growing right next to a river that's fed by salmon. So salmon are really moving in, you know, the phosphorus and all these nutrients, and they're feeding all the animals that are part of these ecosystems where they travel, including humans. And so that movement of nutrients is a vital part of the whole ecosystem of Salmon Nation. And we're seeing what happens when rivers don't have their salmon. This whole ecosystem in the Northwest, along from Alaska all the way down to Big Sur in California, is stressed. There's a lot of stress.
I remember visiting Puerto Rico several years ago and being really shocked to find out how little agriculture there actually was on the island at that period of time. Raj, could you talk a little bit about Puerto Rico before and after Hurricane Maria from a food import standpoint?
I prefer to talk about Puerto Rico before and after the impact of colonialism. I mean, the one of the ways that U.S. colonialism has operated has been to take over satellite states in various ways. But the greater sort of crushing of food systems has happened not so much under the sort of yoke of U.S. imperial enterprises in the past century, so much as the sort of moments of first contact that really began the story of us being separated from our food systems and medicine systems by this story of colonial capitalism. And I think the reason to sort of think about Puerto Rico as an indigenous island colonized, rather than as an island just sort of wrecked by climate change, which, you know, of which sadly there are too many, is because it helps us understand the outside of this problem. If we want a food system that's better, then hoping to turn the clock back before any given storm is to perhaps not be as ambitious as we might be. Because if we're interested in the bigger picture of what a better food system might look like, then the recent past isn't a great place to look. I mean, we've had this conversation before, I think, Evan, where we've discussed whether one should eat what one's grandmother ate or whether it's one's great-great-grandmother. And unfortunately, we have to go back a lot further to be less alienated from our food system than, you know, the modern sort of colonial food system has left us legacies with. I mean, my parents are, you know, in their 80s and suffer from all the diseases of the modern food system that they've peddled in, you know, in part by being vendors of bad food through their convenience stores. You know, I think that rolling the clock back further in time isn't to hanker for a time where there was less science and where, you know, bad dental care ran riot, but much more to look for how it is that the world in which we find ourselves has become broken by colonial capitalism. And we might mend our food system not by hoping for just, you know, less bad US imperialism, but for a process of decolonization that's very 21st century, a 21st century decolonization that would look a lot like the kind of work that Rupa's doing with the Deep Medicine Circle right there in the in occupied Ohlone territory in what is also called the San Francisco Bay Area.
So Rupa, let's talk about deep medicine. Tell us about it.
Well, deep medicine is, in effect, looking at the health of systems and the health of populations, the health of communities, the health of the interactions between communities rather than the health of individuals. Or I should say in addition to, but knowing that you can't stop at improving the health of an individual and think that you're done, that you have to work for the health of the whole system. And that includes the health of the water and the health of the soil and the health of all the people. And so when you recognize that an injury to one is an injury to all, you're working from the place of deep medicine. Deep medicine would look like understanding that if we just vaccinate the global north and leave the global south to develop its own scary variants, those will come back to bite all of us. We have to develop a practice of, you know, getting everyone into the circle, because we cannot afford to leave anybody out, not just because it'll, you know, inadvertently affect us, but because to care for the other is actually how we care for the self. And that goes to like caring for the soil. We know that biodiverse soil holds more water and biodiverse soil sinks more carbon, and that microbiology on the soil ends up on our food, and that ends up impacting our exposures to different microbes. And the more microbes we have in our environments, the more our bodies can adjust and harmonize to those other entities. And in fact, our gut in the United States, urban U.S. dwellers have the least biodiverse guts on Earth. And a lot of that has to do with how sterilized our environments have become, from everything from the soil to the food to, you know, our cleaning products and what they're doing to our homes. And so deep medicine is working on the structural level to advance health for whole systems. It's really incorporating and bridging things that indigenous communities have been doing for thousands of years. We are doing a project called Farming as Medicine, where we're reframing farmers as ecological stewards. And their work is to grow food for people and give that food away so that people who are most oppressed by our social structures have access to the healthiest foods to heal their bodies and their gut. And so that act of farming, then you understand that farmers are really our first healthcare workers, and they should be uplifted and they should be paid like that. And not only in their healthcare work by providing nutrient dense food, but in their healthcare work of stewarding our soils, because it really is our soils that will help repair the whole ecosystem.
Well, for myself, I'm just happy that you, Dr. Rupa Marya, and Raj Patel were friends and that you collaborated on this very fascinating book. Thank you both of you so much.
Thanks so much, Evan. Really appreciate you.
Thank you.
Dr. Rupa Marya and Raj Patel are the force behind Inflamed. Full of metaphor, it is a critical study of the disconnect between health and social justice. Coming up, 50 years ago, Alice Waters revolutionized the way we eat. She joins us to talk about her legacy next.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back to Good Food. You say you want a revolution? Well, in August of 1971, Alice Waters opened Chez Panisse, which came to define what we know as California cuisine, while simultaneously changing the way we think and talk about food. With the restaurant poised to celebrate 50 years, we sit down with the doyenne of sustainability. Hi, Alice.
Hello, Evan.
It's been a long time.
It has.
So I was thinking about this fact that you're going to be celebrating 50 years. And I think back to picking a name and how picking a restaurant name is so akin to naming a child of sorts. When you first do it, you don't really know what it will be because it becomes something of its own apart from you. Were there ever any plans to call Chez Panisse anything else?
There were plans to use another name from the Pagnol trilogy, Fanny, Marius, and César. There was a moment where it was going to be Chez Marius, you know, one of the other names, Chez Pagnol. But it was the old guy who sold the sales and married Fanny, whose name was Panisse. And of course, Panisse means the bread of Nice, the pan de Nice, which is like a little pancake that they make out of chickpea flour and fry. And so I just, yes, it's Panisse.
Well, I think it stuck, so it must have been a good choice. You've been working on the Edible Schoolyard for so long now, and I'm wondering if you feel that there's real traction in larger school districts, or do you feel that it is the same, like, difficult ask for them to really hear what you're saying?
It is a difficult ask because, you know, the fast food industrial system has basically bribed most educational institutions by giving them extra money to have the concession. So for those places, those universities, that K through 12, they don't have enough money to pay teachers and, you know, do all the things that they are asked to do. So they take that money and it comes with fast food. And in order for us to really break through that system, we have to believe, one, that we can cook nutritious school lunches and the kids will love them, number one. Number two, that we can cook food that is within the USDA reimbursement, and we know we can if we be careful about meat and about cheese. We can do this organically, all of it. I'm writing a book about that right now. We put all the food for the book, retail organic, just to know that we could make food that was culturally diverse and food that kids love within those parameters. But it's a much bigger issue than all of this that we have to think about how we're serving kids. But it's going to take a real effort from the top.
I'm curious, do you see yourself in the upheaval that young people are working through right now? Do you feel a sense of kinship with the activists of today?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I was swept away by the free speech movement, civil rights, and I never lost my optimism because of that time. And I felt like if we all got together and wanted to do something, we could do it. It's like Jimmy Carter's Habitat for Humanity. We could build and paint a school in a day and plant a garden all the way around it. I mean, we could. We need to feel empowered. And we've been so disempowered.
There's so much interest now in changing restaurant culture, making the employee experience more welcoming and less punitive. You're famous for giving your chefs enormous latitude. What made you do that? And did it ever lead to any disasters or just unexpected consequences?
Well, I did something that was really imagining myself being the chef for 6 days a week and really having ideas for about three of those days a week and being exhausted all of the time. And I thought after I had a child, I couldn't work more than 3 days a week. And so I decided to divide the chef position in two. Instead of one chef overseeing the cafe and one overseeing the downstairs, there were two, and two in pastry. And they worked 3 days, and I paid them for five. It's really one of the things that I really believe accounts for the longevity of the restaurant, is allowing people to have, you know, time at home, time with their families, having enough time to look through cookbooks, go out to dinner, whatever it takes. And they also come back in a refreshed place. And it's so beautiful for interns who come and work at the restaurant because they don't just have one person's opinion. They have six opinions of how to do something.
Has it made women less afraid to make a commitment to you because they know they can still be mothers?
Yes, and fathers too, both. Yes, that they can have time off with their family. Absolutely. Many, many women are in chef positions right now at Shea. Four out of six. I also feel like the longer they're there, the more able they are to teach the younger people. And this is important to pass on the values from generation to generation. And that's why I feel so confident that she will be around for a while longer. Every year I always say, you know, we should decide whether we want to do it another year. I've never felt just tied to doing it. I've always loved it.
I love that you, because, you know, I've talked to so many restaurateurs during this pandemic period who talk about the blessing that just stopping for a moment allowed them, of being them able to do deep thinks about what they were doing.
Yes.
And where they wanted to go.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know that the stability of the staff is absolutely critical to the survival. And so I want people to feel, you know, really part of the family of the restaurant.
Tell us about the project you're working on here in Los Angeles.
Well, I was just about to mention that the reason that I wanted to do the project was the fact that there's this art museum that has an incredible reputation. And to connect food with art is really important for me. And there you are in the middle of a museum. And it's a museum that's connected to the University of California. So we can hire young people like we've done at Chez Bonnice, and they can be trained in the values, again, of regenerative organic. And we want to buy the food from really local people who are really doing the right thing and support them.
So who is that person that you're entrusting this project to in Los Angeles?
Well, it's with several people. But David Tanis is a very good personal friend of mine, and of course was a main chef at Chez Panisse, both in the cafe and downstairs. But I knew that he wasn't writing as much for the New York Times then. He was in a place of transition with cooking schools around the world, and I just said, David, do you want to do this? And he's always had an eye for art and collaboration, and he said, yeah, I do.
And of course, all this will be happening at the Hammer. We should mention the name of the museum, the Hammer Museum in Westport.
Oh, yes. Yes, it will all be happening at the Hammer Museum.
Well, Alice, I just wanted to say to you personally that for me, what your legacy will ultimately be is what you've done for farmers. In America, I'm pretty sure that no one put a farmer's name on a menu before you did, like film credits, or invited them to the table in the large embrace that you did. And for me, that will always be your legacy.
Thank you, Evan. That means so much because they are the reason that Chez Panisse tastes the way it does. Really, truly.
Alice Waters is the owner of Chez Panisse. The Berkeley Institution celebrates 50 years this month. At Franklin Avenue, my public elementary school here in LA, we didn't have a cafeteria or a microwave. What we did have was the odd convention of a basket that would get passed around the outdoor lunch tables. If there was something in your lunch you didn't like, you could put it in the basket. Once something was in the basket, someone else could choose it. I found it so odd that kids put Oreos in. My mom always sent me to school with those smashed raisin cookies that looked like a street paver had run over them. Did I put my tuna and deli rye with onions in the basket? No. But I did occasionally trade my salami on pumpernickel or the liverwurst on white bread. I suspect a teacher grabbed them out of compassion. School lunch. If yours carries identity, it can create pride and comfort or scar you for life. From tattoo artists and a two-time world heavyweight champion to some of the most recognizable names in food, photographer Lucy Schaefer captures brown paper bags, cafeteria trays, and personal accounts in School Lunch, unpacking our shared stories. Hi, Lucy.
Hi, thanks so much. I loved hearing your story.
Yeah, it was very long time ago and so odd. Why do you think school lunch causes so many universal emotions and memories to bubble up for us?
Yeah, I mean, I think school lunch is at this interesting juxtaposition of culture and family. So a lot of what you get for your school lunch has to do with, you know, what year it is when you're born, what country you're living in, what ethnicity and race and everything that makes up culture, but then pile on top of that who your parents are or who you're being raised by, what your economic situation is, what type of food your parents personally like to eat, and it gets really personal. So it's this interesting juxtaposition of like universal and so personal.
Was there one particular conversation you had with someone that where you just said, oh, yes, this is it? I mean, what you just heard just made you want to collect more stories.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like that kept happening. There's two that stand out and they're so different from each other. But one was a woman who was telling me, oh, yeah, I remember I always wanted the junk food at the cafeteria. My mom gave me healthy lunch. And if she had stopped there, that's like a very universal. Everybody says that. But then she went on to say, I had this great thing where I would sell pictures of my brother to other kids because he was really cute and these girls had crushes on him. So I'd sell pictures of my brother to get money to buy junk food in the cafeteria. So it's like, that's where it took a turn. I was like, okay, now it's a really interesting story. And similarly with George Foreman, like his story is so heartbreaking. He's just this amazing tale that, you know, breaks your heart. He was one of seven kids, and they just didn't have a lot of money at all. There was kind of one meal a day for the family, and it wasn't lunch. So he would blow up an empty paper bag and bring that to school because he didn't want to be laughed at. He didn't want anyone to know his family couldn't afford lunch. And to me, like, those two stories are so different from each other. But at the same time, it really is a lot about what it is to be a kid and, like, what your priorities are and how you problem solve. And you have to play the hand you're dealt in both cases.
Yeah, there's so much navigating for kids around school lunch. Was there very much reminiscing about crusts being cut off?
Oh, yeah, definitely. There was one woman, Michaela Walker, who was complaining her mother gave her the same exact lunch every day for 6 years. And it was a peanut butter and jelly sandwich, an apple, and an apple juice. And she said, and they would have fights about the crusts and how it was cut. And her mom insisted on putting butter between the bread and the jelly, which, you know, there are people who really swear by that to avoid the soggy bread. But it was this thing where this little girl had no control. Her mom was going to make her sandwich a certain way, and that was that. Things like crust being cut off, people have stances on that. Things like whole wheat bread, things like packaged food, you know, it really, people remember these things vividly. Even, you know, a 60-year-old man will tell you the first and last name of the kid who had the better lunch than he did, you know.
What about, did anybody talk about the containers that lunch was packed in? I mean, I grew up so long ago that a lot of the lunchbox situations that are marketed to current parents now didn't exist. So
oh, yeah.
My
Definitely.
Mother always sent me like leftovers in just really sad kind of
Definitely.
repurposed
Definitely.
Containers.
Yeah, there was a lot of that. And I also asked a lot of probing leading questions with people's lunch packaging, because I wanted to recreate the photo later. So I wanted to know if they said it was in a lunchbox. I wanted to know what character was on it. Was it metal? Was it plastic? You mentioned the way that packaging back in the day, it wasn't like an insulated bag the way kids have today. Melissa Clark, who's a food writer for the New York Times, was remembering her lunch, and her mom used to kind of get around that by packing a egg salad sandwich that was kept cold with a frozen little juice box of apple juice. And she said it was a great system. You know, it would kind of thaw out by lunch. You'd have like a little apple juice slushy, and then the sandwich was kept cold. But she said there was one day where it just failed, and her mom had run out of the freezer pack ones or something and put a regular one in. And it was New York City, June, lunchroom with no air conditioning. And by the time she got to lunch and opened it up, she called it the horrible fart day. And it was just like the kids just mocked her for weeks after that because of that container that just didn't cut it back then.
I have such a vivid memory of what the metal lunchbox of my youth smelled like, and the mm-hmm. and the thermoses that never really, you could never really get rid of the previous yep. inhabitant of
exactly.
of the thermos.
And they kind of leaked, you know, you'd get a little trickle onto your sandwich baggie or whatever. Yeah.
How did school lunch differ culturally amongst your storytellers?
Yeah, it really did differ a lot. And some countries, there was a chef that I interviewed who grew up in Morocco, and he was like, school lunch, it wasn't the same. There was no school lunch. It was everybody took a break at lunchtime, went home, and had the biggest meal of the day together with their family. And people came home from work also. So it'd be with his dad, his aunts, his mom, big extended family, had this huge meal, and then everybody went back to school, went back to work. So for him, the idea of, you know, sending a kid with something in a little brown paper bag just seemed crazy and against the culture he grew up with.
Can you describe the TV show Lunch with Casey?
Yeah, so that was, I don't actually know about it other than this interview I did with someone who grew up in Minneapolis at the time that it aired. And so he told me about it. I didn't know about it before then. I think it aired in the 50s, 60s, I'm not sure exactly. And it was a TV show where they would say, they would print the menu in the newspaper in advance and say, okay, on Tuesday, it's going to be a peanut butter and jelly and a Hostess treat. I think they were sponsored by Hostess, so there's usually some kind of Hostess treat and a glass of milk. And if you stayed home from school sick on that day, you could turn it on and sit in front of the TV and eat lunch together with Casey. And now I'm going to take a bite of my carrot sticks. And now I'm going to take a drink of my milk. And the man that I interviewed remembered doing that and making his mom make exactly that lunch. And he had a little TV tray and he'd sit and watch and eat on days that he was homesick from school.
So incredible.
Yeah.
You know, we've talked a little bit about lunch shame. But what about lunch pride? Did anybody share cultural pride through lunch with you?
Yeah, there actually was a couple different stories of that. For example, there was a Puerto Rican story where I actually had the pleasure of interviewing the grandmother, mother, and then daughter. And in the book, I actually only included the grandmother and mother stories. But the grandmother grew up in the 60s in New York City, and her parents were from Puerto Rico and didn't really understand this cafeteria scenario. They wanted their daughter to have hot food, and it was the same for a lot of these Puerto Rican families. So all the moms would make lunch in these little layered tins, hot lunch, and they would line up at the playground during recess, and all the kids would come over, find their mom, and get this hot lunch. And sometimes they would even bring little frozen popsicles and things like that. And the woman recalling the story just loved it. It wasn't that she felt different or strange, like she preferred it that way. So during the actual lunch period, they would just sit there and chat and not eat anything. And then during recess, they'd run over to find their mom and their hot lunch waiting.
God, what an expression of care that is.
Yes. Definitely. Although it was interesting, the next generation, when it came time for her daughter to go to school in New York City, she just got the cafeteria food. She's like, I'm not doing that. So in that daughter's story, well, is more like a tray of pizza. Yeah.
Well, it's just such a fabulous collection. And I think it, like you said at the beginning of our conversation, there's something about school lunch, the intersection where it sits, that says so much about us.
Yes, I know. It really is rich. And I feel like I could make a second edition, because since this book has been out, now I heard your cool story, and everyone I talk to, it's a nice conversation starter, because someone you may have known for 20 years, it's this little tidbit of their life that maybe you don't know.
Well, thank you so much, Lucy.
Yes, thank you. Thanks so much.
That was Lucy Schaefer. She's a photographer. And in her book, School Lunch, she revisits nostalgia of the school cafeteria that goes beyond peanut butter and jelly. In a minute, what's your favorite breakfast burrito in Los Angeles? Find out if it made Bill Avison's list when Good Food continues. You're listening to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleinman. If breakfast truly is the most important meal of the day, Angelenos like to wrap ours in a tortilla. We've nailed the breakfast burrito, and Los Angeles Times restaurant critic has the city's best breakfast burritos all rolled up into a list of his favorites. Here's Bill Addison. Hi, Bill.
Hi, Evan.
I think it's very brave of you to put together a list of this sort, one destined to be slammed by everyone.
By everyone, I know.
How did you decide to define a breakfast burrito for the purposes of your search?
It had to include egg in the mix of ingredients wrapped in the flour tortilla. That was pretty much it, with the exception of a vegan burrito, which I looked for something like a scrambled tofu or something that definitely indicated that it was a morning food wrapped in a flour tortilla.
Can we find good breakfast burritos all over the city, or is there a concentration in a particular neighborhood?
The answer is you can pretty much find a great breakfast burrito in almost every corner of the metro area. Certainly Highland Park has a concentration, and there are debates that I stumbled onto online on sites like LA Taco, where people are giving very forceful opinions about lists being presented. And they're also doing that thing where they don't want to they're like, this list is terrible, but also I'm not telling you where my favorite is because I want to keep it like private and I don't want lines outside. But I could have done an exploration of Highland Park on its own.
Wow.
I'm going to do something for you that I did not do for the LA Times.
Which is?
I am going to give you my top five.
Oh my God. Okay. That is perfect. Top five, go.
Machine at Milpa Grill. It's a pop-up, a long-term, open-ended pop-up run by Jonathan Perez. This is in Boyle Heights. He scrambles Swiss cheese into the eggs, and it creates this beautiful creaminess and nuttiness. He's a tater tot guy. He spices them. They add crunch. He's got birria as a filling, pork belly with avocado salsa, which was a favorite, and longaniza with salsa matcha. I love those. I'm not going to officially say that's my favorite, but if you ask me if I want to go have a breakfast burrito, that's the first place I'm going to suggest we head.
Okay.
Okay. Angry Egret Dinette, Wes Avila, hometown hero. This is his new place after leaving Gorilla Tacos. Do you remember the first Gorilla Taco you ever had, Evan?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. He made a burrito that reminded me of the first taco of his that I ever had. It's typical, like, Avila mad genius. It had fried eggs, asparagus, Parmesan, potatoes, red pepper sauce, and an almond salsa. And it was amazing. And it tastes like no other breakfast burrito in town. And you probably can't even get it anymore because he's always switching things up. But anything else that he comes up with, you should try it too.
I mean, pretty much everything he's doing over there right now is pretty stellar.
Super special. I'm way into that restaurant. I covered it some in the darkest months of the pandemic at the end of 2020, but I keep telling myself I need to go write more about it because it's whiplash creativity over there.
Okay, so that's two down. You owe us three more.
All Day Baby. Personal favorite, I love this restaurant. Lynn Ta and Jonathan Whitener's Corner Diner in Silver Lake. I've loved them since they opened the recently closed Here's Looking at You in Koreatown. When I think of what makes a breakfast burrito great, I think of a $5 word. It's amalgamation, right? Like everything inside needs to like not just be good onto its own, but it all needs to kind of squish and connect in the right ways. And this breakfast burrito does it. It's kind of molten. Pockets of jack cheese, salsa roja, longaniza that's like crumbly and delicious. And it's sort of like a jiggly mass, but it works. It's absolutely delicious.
Beans or no beans?
Refried pintos in that one. That helps with the kind of like barely held together, but delicious quality.
So has your loyalty to the biscuit crumbled?
My choice would usually be to order both, but oof, that would just send me back to bed. So now I have to make a choice.
Okay, so what is next?
Lily's in Malibu, which was a surprise to me. My colleague, Stephanie Brigeau, who grew up in Malibu, took me there. Lily Castro has run this institution for 32 years, and she made a burrito that I was looking for specifically, which was one filled with machaca, which is the jerky-like dried beef that is traditional in northern Mexico and is very common at breakfast scrambled with eggs and is common in a burrito that one would consume in the morning in that area. It was pretty hard to find, and Lily's had my favorite. It's, again, the refried pintos, but with scrambled eggs, jack cheese, tomato, onion, and pepper in there. Really nice, gushy, satisfying.
That sounds wonderful.
Yeah.
Machaca burritos were always my burritoist of choice as a teenager, so I need to drive out and try this.
It's a beautiful location, too, and it's nice to just sit there and kind of watch the marine layer lift while you're eating that delicious burrito.
Okay, so there's one more.
It's Gorilla Cafecito, which is the coffee shop sibling to Gorilla Tacos, now run by Brittany Vaez. It was just one of those things. I didn't know what to expect. It's a pretty new operation, and they nailed it. It's the hash browns in there that make this burrito. They have two variations: scrambled eggs, bacon, cheese, mashed avocado, pintos, with the hash browns, delicious, almost like potato sticks, like really crackly. And then I'm going to break my must-include egg rule by mentioning the second one, which also includes hash browns, but also cheddar and cubes of grilled steak with two salsas in there, an avocado, a thinner guacamole type, and a chili de árbol. And even though it has no egg, it tasted like breakfast, and it was awesome.
Oh, yum. Thank you so much for this list.
Thanks for having me on to talk about it, Evan.
That's Bill Addison. He's the restaurant critic for the Los Angeles Times. Check out his recommendations by visiting kcrw.com/goodfood. The Market Report is on deck. Stay with us. I'm Evan Kleiman, and this is Good Food. And now it's to the farmer's market we go to find out what's in season this mid-September weekend. Jillian Ferguson is there with her weekly report.
This is Jillian Ferguson with the Market Report. I'm in Santa Monica this week with Travis Passerotti, who is the executive chef at the Tasting Kitchen on Abbot Kinney in Venice. And Travis, I see you here every single week. I have this distinct memory, actually, of the earliest, bleakest days of the pandemic when no one was at the market. And you were one of the chefs who was here every week checking in with all the farmers. I will always remember that. And you continue to come to the market every week. So we're in the very last days of summer. What are you shopping for this week?
This week, it's sweet peppers. Towards the end of the summer, it's just one of those flavors that is really excellent and really captures that transition from the end of summer into autumn.
Yeah. So when you're saying sweet peppers, is this the same thing that some of us would call bell peppers in the grocery store?
Yes and no. Yes, they are both sweet. I tend to look for a few specific varieties that wouldn't be as widely available as a commercial bell pepper. Probably my three go-tos are Jimmy Nardello peppers, which are a long, skinny, thin-skinned sweet pepper. Pimento, which are a short, squat, bulbousy, round pepper that, again, is thin skin, super thick flesh, very sweet, very savory. And both of the Toro peppers, which is the Cornel del Toro and the Cornel del Oro, the red and yellow variety of the Italian sweet pepper.
And are these all Italian pepper varieties that you're looking for? The Tasting Kitchen is mostly an Italian restaurant, right?
It is, very Italian-influenced. The Jimmy Nardellos were, initially cultivated in Connecticut by a Calabrian immigrant. He, stuffed some seeds in his pocket and brought them over so he could have some of the old world and his new world. And they've more recently seen a resurgence in the market here, probably over the last, 3 or 4 years.
Yeah, all the chefs fight over them. I feel like they are that classic fire engine red, just gorgeous pepper that you would see in a storybook. How do you like to use them at the restaurant?
I'm really into these ones, pretty much any way that you can, configure them out. But I'd say, one of my go-tos is making a dish called pepperonata, which also hails from southern Italy. In its simplest form, just stewed peppers, garlic, onions, olives, a little bit of oregano, and just a tiny splash of vinegar. You'll see the addition of tomatoes a lot of the times in pepperonata recipes, which makes it a little bit saucier. I like starting them on the stovetop, and then once I've sweat out the peppers, the onion, garlic, added my olives and oregano, added the little bit of vinegar, I'll then put them into the oven to really just get a nicer roast on there just from the indirect heat.
And are you just serving those with a slice of delicious bread?
I mean, that's one of the best things about this dish is you can do whatever you want. I love it on burrata with anchovies and breadcrumb. I love it on polenta, either creamy if it's a little bit colder, or cakes. And you can just have the whole thing room temp. It's really just one of those things that, to me, it's just so incredibly versatile that it's just lovely to have around.
Sounds great. Thank you so much, Travis.
No problem.
That was Travis Passerotti. He is the executive chef at Tasting Kitchen on Abbot Kinney in Venice. They are open for business with a lot of outdoor dining. Cuco Arambula is the farmer at Balick Family Farms in Fillmore who grows the sweet peppers that Travis buys. And Cuco, your table is weighed down with just a gorgeous rainbow of peppers right now. Travis was particularly talking about the sweet peppers. Can you pick maybe two or three varieties that you grow on the farm and tell us about them?
Well, the most popular for us is the sweet, super sweet pimento, lipstick, and toro de oro, a long yellow pepper. Those are the most popular. Pimento is a flat pepper, not big like bell peppers. Sweet. It's like an heirloom tomato. And the skin is very thin. It disappears in your mouth. I love it.
Okay, and you also mentioned the lipstick pepper. Is that named because it looks like a little tube of lipstick?
Probably because the color and the shape and everything, yeah. And it's sweet. Sweet like the pimento, but different flavor. More fruity flavor.
More fruity. Okay, and what was the third one you mentioned?
Oh, toro de oro. That's a special one. Very good on fajitas. That one starts from green to orange completely.
And what does that name mean? What does it translate to?
Toro de oro means a gold, you know, those horns or whatever. Yeah, that's what it means.
Golden horns.
Uh-huh. Golden horn.
Okay. All right. And you do have a few of the not super spicy, but those peppers that are sort of in between sweet and spicy, the poblanos, the Anaheims.
Anaheims, they are the only ones we have mild.
Okay.
If you want spicy, we have the habanero. Habanero is spicy.
And sometimes you call the poblanos anchos. Are they the same thing?
There's three different varieties, ancho, poblano, and pasilla, same family. And we stayed with this because it's the best. I try them all on chile rellenos, and this is the one we like, and that's the one we keep growing.
That's how you like to eat these, as chile rellenos?
Chile rellenos.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you so much. I appreciate you taking time out of your busy day.
Sorry, but you know how I am. Okay.
Thank you, Cuco. That was Cuco Arambula. He is one of the busiest farmers here at the market today. He works with Balick Family Farms up in Fillmore. You can find them at a ton of farmers markets all over LA. Check out their blog at balickfarms.com to find out what markets they're attending each week. For the Market Report, I'm Jillian Ferguson.
If you missed any of today's show, listen on our website or in KCRW's mobile app. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or Spotify. My thanks to the Good Food team, Jillian Ferguson, Laurel Garcia, and Desmond Taylor. Special thanks to Laura Kondarajan, Amy Ta, Kenny Ng, Gary Messiha, and Paul Smith. I'm Evan Kleiman. Enjoy the weekend, everyone. I'll be back next week with another episode of Good Food.